GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's been 1 month, 1 week, and 1 day since Donald Trump took office. The president is slated to deliver a speech to a joint session of Congress tonight outlining his agenda. As the Trump administration rolls out its plans, the nation remains divided over issues like immigration, abortion rights, and alternative facts. The president's distrust of the media is no secret. He's made that clear throughout his campaign and into his presidency.
We are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake. A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people. Because they have no sources. They just make them up when there are none.
Despite the president's accusations about fake news, Trump administration officials have repeatedly said things that are not true. The role of journalism in a Trump-led America is under intense scrutiny. I recently hosted a panel discussion at the Atlanta Press Club on the unique challenges the press faces in a new combative political environment. I was joined in that discussion by New York Times national correspondent Richard Fawcett, Fox News producer David Lukowitz, Wall Street Journal political reporter Cam McWhirter, and CNN political director David Chalian. Here's a portion of that discussion held before a live audience. David Chalian, let me start with you, because the place where I thought we were going to begin changed because of the tweet we got from the president, which I'm sure that you all read. And I know this is... we're laughing about this subject, but I feel as though this tweet sort of takes us into a different place, perhaps. And let me ask you how we should respond to this. And I want to read the tweet again. It was, "The fake news media failing New York Times, NBC News, ABC, CBS, CNN is not my enemy. It is the enemy of the American people." How are we to absorb that?
To fundamentally take the free press and say they are an enemy of the American people, I think helps the press do its job, because I think that kind of statement is so over the top that while no doubt many of Donald Trump's supporters will champion that statement, I think for the great swath, the majority of the country, that is not within sort of bounds of this conversation about the press and its role. It is so out of bounds that I think it's recognizable by a majority of the country as absurd. And so I think it puts us, when he goes that far in what he's trying to do in terms of his relationship with the press, I think it puts us on a stronger footing with the public to be able to continue to do our job.
Now, some people have said absolutely that. Senator McConnell said you shouldn't take the president's tweet seriously. Senator Rand Paul said, "I haven't seen any legislation coming forward that wants to limit the press. I just see President Trump expressing his opinion." But Richard, let me put this to you, because should we not be taking the president's tweets seriously?
Can I get a lifeline? Is that working?
You may not.
So this last tweet, I mean, on the one hand, it's like sticks and stones. Politics ain't beanbag, it ain't kickball, as people have said in the past. So, you know, some guy says a thing about you and you go, okay, whatever. On the other hand, in the last 36 hours, 48 hours, I've heard two very serious concerns about this last tweet. One is that it undermines the president's ability and the administration's ability to go to foreign countries and make the case that a free and open press is indeed one of the great cornerstones of a liberal democracy. I don't know if he really has the ability to make that case anymore. I am concerned in a country where we have a lot of sort of unstable people running around that you're going to say that certain news organizations are enemies of the people. I just don't think it's wise for the president to say that. So I think we should take those ramifications seriously.
So let me take that to you, David L., because the danger that Richard is alluding to is something other people have also been concerned about. Chris Cuomo just said somebody is going to get hurt at some point. Do you feel as though journalists are now at a higher risk?
Day to day, we walk and we do our jobs as best we can. But the reality is, I covered many Trump rallies over the course of the campaign where, truth be told, we weren't the main target. But hearing them say CNN sucks and the way they were yelling, and to see an entire crowd of people turn around and face the press and say the things that they were saying, not knowing who I work for versus my colleague right next to me. A colleague from NBC had to be walked out to her car by the Secret Service. Katie Tour, by the Secret Service at one of the events we were at. So I think that it's a real concern that more and more of our news organizations are looking at.
Okay, so then, Cam, let's go to the press briefings themselves. And this is something all of you, all four of you, will get a chance to weigh in on. But let's start with who the president and Sean Spicer are calling on, which has become an issue. For example, during the press conference with Benjamin Netanyahu, he took two questions. One was from the Christian Broadcasting Network, and the other was from a conservative website called Town Hall. Should we be... Is there anything we can do about that, the way the press briefings are being run and who's being called on?
I think the answer to that simply is no, you can't. And I think presidents have always been doing that sort of thing. They're playing that game. I think the larger issue is, are you going to be getting your information from a press briefing with the president? And the answer, I think, is no. You may be getting news from those events, but you're not going to be learning. That's not how we're going to learn about this administration.
But that brings us to another issue. And let me put this to you, David C., because Joy Reid, who's the host of AM Joy on MSNBC, suggested that perhaps we shouldn't be covering these press briefings, at least not covering them live, or we shouldn't be sending our senior correspondents. Some people have said, send an intern.
We have great interns at CNN. They're right here. I'd be happy to send
them. We do at GPB, too.
Good up for interns.
I don't think we will forever cover Sean Spicer briefings live. I think if you go back and look at the first 100 days of the Obama administration, we covered a lot of Robert Gibbs briefings live. I think when the administration is new, the news value is a little higher on what's coming out of the president's spokesman's mouth early on. I will say it is not a blanket decision, oh, we're just going to take this live. In fact, you may recall the first weekend of the administration, Sean went into the briefing room to give a presentation about crowd size at the inauguration.
Yeah, the one with all the pictures.
Yeah, with all the pictures up. And he didn't take any questions. He just went out there to put out falsehoods. CNN did not take that live because it was clear what Sean Spicer was going to do, and we made the determination to... we would turn the sound around, but immediately put a reporter on with the Spicer sound to contextualize what he was saying with fact, as opposed to just letting him make this false presentation live. It was also our sense that he wasn't going to take questions, so it wasn't really what we would determine sort of a briefing in that way. I think, though, I don't see a problem with taking it live right now. And I also just want to add one thing. Yes, it has been president strategies long before this president to pick on certain reporters and look for friendlier questions at times. But, to Donald Trump's credit, when he did finally come out and give his first solo news conference and stood there for an hour, 17 minutes, we could talk about the press conference at length, I'm sure, but he did sort of go around to the full spectrum of outlets before him at that news conference.
So now we're kind of getting to what is... for journalists, I think, the crux of our problem. And this became a problem at NPR that became an open discussion because our ombudsman posted something saying she doesn't believe NPR should have some of these surrogates on live because they can't be fact-checked. So I want all four of you to start weighing in on this. Is this problem of blatant falsehoods coming from official sources? If our responsibility is to present the truth, to find the truth and then present that truth to the public, how do we handle just absolute lies, untruths, whatever you may want to call them, coming from the White House? And let me go, I'll go the other way. Sorry, Cam, let's start with you.
Well, we're not live television. So we have we're slightly saved from that problem. But I mean the and the issue of what is a truth, what is an untruth, and what is a lie has been debated. I think the issue is this is going to sound simplistic, but we are always doing it. We've always been doing this. We've always are fact-checking. The Obama administration didn't always tell the truth. They didn't always present. They presented their own positions. This is a more extreme situation we're in, but it's basically the same work we're always doing, which is if somebody tells you something, they may be trying to snow you, and you have to find out if that's the truth. And that's true if it's Kasim Reed or President Trump. They're all politicians at some point. I don't care if it's a city council meeting. I don't care where it is they're going to try to snow a reporter. And so if we're doing our jobs, we're always, that radar is always on.
David Eld, this has become a problem with, there's actually a number of people, including journalistic ethicists, saying that, well, it's, I guess, not as big of a deal, a question anymore, but we're saying stop interviewing Kellyanne Conway. What do we do about this?
Well, I mean, it's a challenge for any network at any time who we put on our air. But the reality is, as Cam said, our job is to allow them to say what they're saying and then fact check them. We have to, I can't be the muzzle on Kellyanne Conway or anybody else. The administration is going to put out what they believe they need to put out. And our job as reporters is to be just that, good reporters. Fact check it, ask other people. You know, things have changed in the media. It's a 24-hour news cycle now, and it's more immediate than it was. Now it's a tweet versus, you know, one evening newscast at 6 o'clock in the evening. But the fundamentals of what we do remains the same. We still need to do our job as reporters, and that's dig for the truth. And if we don't believe what somebody's saying, look into it.
And yet, David C., this has become problem A, possibly because of the 24-hour news cycle, that a lot of our airtime is less reported stories and more straight up interviews, right? And in an interview, it's very difficult to fact check live.
There's no doubt that it's difficult to fact check live. Just because it's difficult, I don't think excuses us for not doing it. I think that we have to rise to that challenge. In fact, you brought up Kellyanne Conway. I think my colleague Jake Tapper had a really wonderful example of how to fact check in a live interview situation. Kellyanne Conway was on her air nonstop for 25 minutes with Jake Tapper, and he constantly was questioning her assumptions using facts, using reported truth to push back when she was saying something that was contrary to that. I think that, you know, that serves our audience well when our audience can see the administration being held accountable in real time based on reported facts.
That's CNN political director David Chalian talking with me at a recent panel discussion hosted by the Atlanta Press Club. Just ahead, more of that discussion on the media's role in covering the Trump administration. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. All this hour, we listened to a recent panel discussion I moderated at the Atlanta Press Club. The topic, the challenges facing the media in its coverage of the Trump presidency. I was joined by four panelists, New York Times national correspondent Richard Fawcett, Fox News producer David Lukowitz, Wall Street Journal political reporter Cam McWhirter, and CNN political director David Chalian. I asked Richard how journalists can pursue the truth when many Americans believe the media is spreading so-called fake news.
I've been trying to think in the bigger sense of what's going on in the country right now. And I came across this phrase, this French phrase, l'appel du vide, which means apparently it's like one of those great German words, it's 99 letters long, that means this wonderful thing, and you think, why do we not have a word like that in English? It means the call of the void. It means when you're standing, no, it's great. It means the way I understand it is you're standing in front of the thresher on the farm and you go, what if I stuck my hand in there? And I think there are so many reasons that the Trump phenomenon exists. And I've been wondering if and I don't know if we're really, and I don't know if this answers your question at all, but this is what I think at 3 a.m. after 6 drinks, is like, what's happened here has something to do, the reason people are attracted to Trumpism has something to do with economic circumstances. It has something to do with race. It has something to do with people upset with Barack Obama. It has something to do with people wanting a fifth Supreme Court justice to be a conservative. But I think there's something deeply irrational about it. And I don't think there's anything we can do about that. This story that my colleague Jim Rutenberg wrote, but it was about the fact that apparently the president is in contact with Alex Jones. We don't know how regularly. Alex Jones I never heard of, and so I saw a YouTube video when I was doing a story on Memphis where he believes that the Illuminati are controlling Memphis, Tennessee from the top of that pyramid that's now a Bass Pro Shop. And
that's not even the most outlandish of his beliefs, actually.
So, I mean, I don't think there's, I mean, I mean, what do you do when you're living in a world where people are choosing to embrace irrationality? This is a question for like snooty French philosophers. Which, you know,
don't have any of those, so let me.
If you have, come see me after the show. If you
want. Let me go to our other three panels. Either of you want to talk about this? What do we do when do we have any responsibility? Is there any way that we contributed to this anti-fact, anti-expert atmosphere?
I would say no. But I think technology has. But I also think that our duty as reporters, as journalists, is to present the facts. And that's the end of our job. And it's important to know that we're not more important than that. That's it. That's our job. And so what my opinion is, who cares what my opinion is? This is a fact. I'm presenting it to you.
But
what they do with it is their business.
We're living in an era, and if you have a question, you can go to the mic and I'll get to you. But we're living in an era where being objective is actually seen as being political.
Correct. But I mean, this was happening before President Trump. I was in Chattanooga. I was reporting, this is 4 years ago, I'm reporting a story, and I'm meeting an elderly couple at a political rally, and the couple, very pleasant, talking to me, and the guy says, I hate Obama, gives a bunch of reasons why he hates Obama. Fine, I'm taking my notes. And I said, and then he goes, Obama's a Muslim. And I said, well, I'm hearing what you're saying about all these reasons you don't like the president, but in fact, he's not a Muslim. He goes to this church and he's a liar. And I just realized at that point, like there was nothing, if I had flown President Obama to my side and I had brought his minister and we had sat with him for an hour, he wouldn't have believed me.
Yeah.
And it's just, there are people that we meet on the job who aren't going to believe a fact.
We have a question.
This kind of dovetails right into your statement there. My name is Chris. Do we need to explain civics to our audiences? And I know this sounds very, no,
I know
hear me
it sounds
out.
Snarky, but it's, you know what? This is absolutely my horse that I'm beating to death on my Twitter feed, which is, and let's go to this question, is part of this problem, let me go to you first, David C., is part of our problem the fact that we got rid of civics education in public schools?
I don't know. I don't know that that's part of our problem in the
press. I mean,
press
America's
right now.
Problem.
Well, but that's for another panel. I can't. I'm not here to solve America's problems.
Betsy DeVos problem.
But clearly, I do think part of our mission is in our reporting to educate our audiences about the system when it comes to government and reporting on government, the systems and processes that are supposed to work in a certain way as spelled out in the Constitution. I think that is part of the fact pattern that we can present when we build fact upon fact in telling our stories. And I do think that that's an important piece of it, the education component of it.
Richard, let me put this to you because there became a question for about the Trump administration and whether or not they understood checks and balances when the president was tweeting that he didn't understand how the judicial branch was trying to usurp the power of the presidency, right? So have we now gone generation after generation of people not quite understanding how the government works?
I think there's a broader problem, and I think it's a problem that probably all of us share, and that is that the world has just become increasingly complex to the point where it's very difficult to wake up in the morning, feed your kids, go do your job, most of us are working in this country, who are working, are working insane hours. You know, there's not, you know, we don't live in France where I assume they're all sitting around smoking Gauloises and taking care of other people's children. So we have this stuff to do, and you have to come home and you have to say, how am I supposed to understand TPP? I mean, if we printed out TPP, it would be the size of this room. And so I think we're all susceptible to these, it creates all kinds of issues where you know, how do you take a position on an issue? And I think it opens up a lane for people who have beautiful, simple, monosyllabic solutions. And they're great entertainers too. And they can give you the answer, an answer that makes sense. But a lot of times life is messier than that. And I don't know how you solve that problem. I mean, I suffer from this problem as well.
Question.
My name's Camille Penley. I'm a freelance journalist. And one thing that has kept coming up since the election and trying to understand what happened is the change in journalism over the last couple of decades and the complete sort of like evaporation of local journalism, or what some would call evaporation. All of you represent, you know, large mainstream news organizations. Have you heard anything internally about a shift to trying to address that gap, even if it's sending that your current staff, you know, I guess, what are your thoughts on that?
Cam, let's go to you first. Will we see a re-emphasis on local reporting?
I think there's an emphasis, I think, at both the Times and the Journal. There's a new emphasis on what we would call national reporting and understanding America. And I think there's a great sense that that we didn't understand what was happening. We knew Trump had supporters, but we didn't quite understand what was evolving. Who are these people, and why do they choose the candidate they did, and what do they want out of America? And I think there's going to be an emphasis on that. But you know, I came from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution to the Journal, and you know, they've suffered mightily in terms of layoffs, et cetera, but they're still doing great work. And I hope that they keep doing that, because we wouldn't have exposed the cheating scandal at the Atlanta Public Schools. We wouldn't have done that.
The Journal wouldn't, but the AJC did.
But the AJC did, mm-hmm. And because you're going to need local, strong local media.
Yeah, it was the Free
media.
Press in Detroit that took down Kwame Kilpatrick, and
yes.
But Richard.
Well,
I
would argue the Detroit News had a hand in that too.
Yes, absolutely.
I used to work there.
So, Richard, let me put this to you, because you actually spent a good amount of time in Middle America in the lead up to the election, and one of the complaints about the news media is that we're in a bubble. Especially the New York Times gets this complaint all the time, elitist, coastal, and that part of the reason that November 6th was a surprise to many people is because we don't listen to real America.
So the Times, our current configuration in the South, which is the region I cover, is me, who's only have people from the South from my background, some of whom are very, very working class, many of whom are very, very working class. And then our other people are from Alabama, Atlanta, and Alabama. So I feel like right now we're configured in such a way in the South that, you know, we're not coming down as Upper West Side elitists who think we're on Mars. Like, we understand the people we're speaking to, I think. This broader divide, though, is serious. I mean, it's interesting when the Times is called out by the president. I think he's speaking to a group of people that message is resonating. The people for whom this is not an absurdity, but the people who say, you know, hell yeah. I don't think it's coming from our readers, which is, in a way, is kind of disturbing. Like, I think our country, it's a sign of our lack of civic health. That when Trump said that, nobody wrote letters to the Times saying, yeah, I'm canceling my subscription. Like, all 3 million subscribers of the Times or whatever it is, were all just like, well, he cray. You know?
And everybody else was. Subscriptions went through the roof.
Yeah, but a lot of other people were like, yeah, but these were not people who are consuming what we write. And that's our big challenge, is that I feel like we put out a very fair-minded report from this part of the country, but it's just a challenge of getting people to read.
To your point about, you know, we at CNN, obviously, we've been taking a beating from the president, you may have heard. And so,
no, I didn't hear.
And so we, Jeff Zucker was you know, concerned enough about that, he talked about this recently to press reporters last week in New York, that he did a huge brand survey after the election for CNN to see how much this has hurt the CNN brand, have the leader of the free world bashing you every day, and what kind of impact that has. And it was really interesting what they found. I mean, not only obviously our audience levels are up, and I think there's a really engaged public now, just like your readership is up. As to, I think people just have the question of what is going on, and they, you know, want to tune in for that. But he found, much like we find in our public opinion surveys about Congress, people hate the media, but they like their media. People hate Congress, they like their congressmen. And it's the same kind of thing that we found in this brand survey, is that it really hasn't diminished CNN's brand in any way, which I thought was really interesting and not necessarily something people would have expected. And I just want to add one other quick thing about the previous conversation. I think it's a little overblown. I see my colleague Marty Savage here has done amazing work out in the country, speaking to voters, you know, going repeatedly out in the country. I think it's a little overblown that we missed the country or what was going on in the country. I just don't think that's true. For any reporter who was out on the campaign trail and talked to voters and went to a Trump rally and saw this, it wasn't missed. I mean, we covered it a lot as to the enthusiasm, what was happening, this different appeal. I do think we missed the lack of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton. I think we missed that as a story. Mm-hmm. And the dampening of her vote, I think, was a much bigger surprise than that Trump voter showed up. I think that's the side of the equation that we missed, actually, more than missing something that, because of our elitist coastal sensibilities, that somehow we missed flyover country. I don't think that's true. And I think it's important, as Marty continues to do the work he's doing, to stay out in the country is hugely important. To stay in touch with Trump supporters is hugely important, but not at the expense of covering the totality of the country as well. I mean, he is not just the president of Trump supporters right now. He is the president of the entire country. And so that is an important story to tell, that even to get at that divide, that yes, there is this population that is very enthusiastic for him, but we can't also lose sight, because we think somehow we missed something in the election, about the larger, broader story about how the overall American population is responding to the Trump presidency.
Question.
Hi, I'm Emily Pelton. I'm not a journalist. I am the director of Voices for Georgia's Children, which is a statewide child policy and advocacy organization, and I'm an avid consumer of many of your news outlets for information. I think aside from claims about liberal bias, elitism in the media, polarization, this new enthusiasm for Trump among some voters, there's an underlying issue that's even more important, and it's part of my daily work, which is income inequality in America. Racism is another major piece of, I think, the conversation about Trump, but just sticking with income inequality and the claims that have been made by the president and his campaign for what's going to get better under the Trump presidency. And in my past life, I was an analyst at the Office of Management and Budget in the Clinton administration, and I was just saying to my colleagues here at the table, I don't see that how the math adds up.
What's your question?
So my question is, how can the news media hold this administration accountable for making life better for not just the Trump voters, but for the American public? How can that conversation emerge from the daily Twitter feed in a way that's meaningful?
And this has been a common thing, especially if you follow social media. People keep saying the media is getting distracted. They're getting distracted from the real policies. Let me go to you, David L., first. Are we getting distracted? Are we catching all of the smaller stories?
I think in the aggregate, we are catching them. I will say that, you know, the tweet of the day clearly comes front and center, but it's not at the expense of everything else. Gets a lot of attention. But if you look at the immigration policy and the executive order he signed, there was plenty of coverage on that. When you look at many of the other things he's done, there was plenty of coverage on that. That doesn't mean we can't also cover a tweet. No, the administration says, look at what he's doing, not to what he's saying. But I think both of those are part of the equation. We have to watch what he's doing.
They're not the only ones to say that. Many leaders in the GOP say that. Ignore the tweets.
Okay, but the tweets are what he's saying. And so it's a part of the equation that needs to be reported on. Because if the tweet is different than the action, there's an inconsistency that we need to point out.
That was Fox News producer David Lukowitz speaking to me at the Atlanta Press Club last week. It's part of a panel discussion on the challenges that journalists face in covering the Trump administration. More of that conversation in just a moment. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. This hour, we listened to a recent panel discussion that I moderated at the Atlanta Press Club on the media's coverage of President Trump. He often refers to certain coverage as fake news, while his administration continues to say some things that are not true. I spoke about this with four journalists: New York Times national correspondent Richard Fawcett, Fox News producer David Lukowitz, Wall Street Journal political reporter Cam McWhirter, and CNN political director David Chalian. They took a question from an audience member, longtime Atlanta journalist Maria Saporta.
Senator John McCain actually went there and said that the danger that we may have as a country is that this is a precursor to dictatorship when you start trying to get rid of a free press. Can you all discuss how serious is this? I mean, at the Atlanta Press Club, we had our retreat. We did a lot of self-analysis and reflection of what should we do and how should we respond. But can you talk about, are we going into some very dangerous territory? Many folks that I know have said, this feels like 1939. Can y'all talk a little bit about where we are?
And let me add a couple indications that have been concerning, particularly, so we'll start with you, David C., Jared Kushner's meeting in which he complained about CNN to the parent company that has had a kind of a chilling effect from people. Are we getting indications right now that even if most people take this with a smirk, that there could be serious...
Sorry, I didn't want to cut you off. Do you want to say...
No, go ahead.
Serious. First of all,
consequences was the end, but go
there
ahead.
There you go. Thank you. John McCain went there, but as John McCain often does, he went there and then remembered the next sentence was he, of course, was not making any comparison that Donald Trump was a dictator. He followed that line. Sometimes it gets left out of the soundbite that you might see. Clearly, there is a strategic initiative inside the Trump administration to undermine the press as an institution. I don't think we're the only institution that there are strategic initiatives inside the White House to try and undermine.
But we are the only one that's enshrined in the Constitution.
Yes.
Judiciary.
I was going to say the judiciary is in the Constitution.
But that's not an industry.
I do think that is clear. I don't think there's really a debate about that. There is a desire to undermine us. And, I think that I really do believe that we can shake in our boots about that. But that to me is like a very standing still kind of thing. So like, to me, we just have to keep doing our job as vigorously as we possibly can. And it goes back to what folks were saying earlier on this panel. It goes back to presenting the facts of each and every story that we're trying to tell in a clear way that informs the public and holds the administration accountable. I don't think we have a larger role than that to play here.
Richard, Kim, or David L., do I want to weigh on this?
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Kim.
We've all been mulling this over a lot. And you can take this for what it's worth, but this spring I've decided to read, which I never had read the whole thing, Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. So you can ask why I'm doing that, but anyways, that's what I'm doing. So Gibbon is like, he's using all these primary sources to write about the Roman Empire and what happened and what went wrong. And a lot of the primary sources are biased. And he talks about what he calls the great law of impartiality that's required of the historian, that you have to constantly hew to that. You have to constantly go to this great law to be as impartial as you can with what you have, with the facts that you have. And I found it very comforting, and I think that that's basically it. That's what we do. And if somebody wants to take those facts and throw them out, if someone wants to take those facts and try to twist them for their own political advantage, that's their business. Our job under the Constitution is to present the truth, and as we can determine it. And so to me, that's the end of it. And I'm excited about this administration, and I think it's going to be an interesting time. It already is. And we've only been at it a month.
It's job security, isn't it?
Right.
My concern is more right now, my sense of it is that we have a lot of disturbing talk, but it's just that. It's just talk. I think the real concern right now is trying to corrupt the stream of information with untrue information. And when we were talking earlier about the fact that he's calling on conservative news outlets, I think it's fantastic that he's calling on conservative news outlets. My concern is when some of those news outlets are known to be spreading falsehoods, which has been the case with a couple of them.
Several of them, yeah. A question.
Hi, I am Betsy McKay from the Wall Street Journal. I've got a question of tactics, I think primarily for David C., but anyone else who wants to weigh in. I'm just wondering what you think about how much the media need to work together, particularly in responding to, you know, some of these falsehoods or the president's predilection for not calling on correspondents he doesn't want to hear from, like your own recently. You know, we're all competitors, so we don't really want to work together, but what do you think we need to do, if anything, to respond collectively?
Well, this is a small example to answer your question, but one thing that I do think, and I think we've been seeing some of this, quite frankly, from the White House press corps in the last few weeks, both in the briefings with Sean Spicer and in opportunities that they have with the president, is a real dedicated core mission to follow up when questions are not answered. So you see now in the briefing room several reporters, whatever question they had formulated in their mind for their moment with Sean Spicer in the briefing, quickly drops away when the previous questioner did not get an answer to their question. I think that helps tremendously hold them accountable for their words if we are relentless collectively in not letting them get away without answering a valid question.
Yeah. Question.
Yes, Jennifer Grove with Channel 2. I think the term media has just become this all-encompassing, any content creator that comes across my, you know, Facebook feed must be the media. What is the danger in lumping everyone together, and what can we do to educate people, kind of to the point earlier?
Do we have any control over how we're labeled? Let me put that to you, David L.
I've been called a lot worse than the media. But... but with that,
I don't know. That's what the EPA describes what goes in your toilet bowl.
It is changing. But I mean, that's just the nature of it today. You know, my kids consume news very differently than I consumed news, and I consume news very differently than my parents consume news. And I think that's just part of it.
Question.
I'm Jimmy Smith. I'm an architect, and I travel to the Middle East. I've been working there for a little over a decade, and will continue. Although the topic is America divided, a lot of the world looks at our administration as the leader of the free world, and we have our press. And with that division, how do you think that is being perceived abroad, and or how that's going to be impacting our relations?
What are you talking about? Our political divisions or our opinion of our president?
The president is looked out abroad as sort of the leader of the free world.
Yeah.
And given the fact that there's such division here, how is that being perceived, and how is that impacting our relations abroad and the view of America?
Have you guys been overseas? I mean, the Women's March was the largest protest in American history. Anybody want to handle this question about?
I mean, I worked in, I'm not, I haven't been there since this election, but I used to work as a foreign correspondent. And, you know, I guess one thing that's just striking to me is how fluent people in other countries are about the very very minor ins and outs of our politics. Our somewhat parochial politics lead the news in a lot of parts of the world.
It's 'cause CNN is in all the airports.
That's right. maybe so. But I think the only thing we can say right now, I think we're going to see how this shakes out, and there's been a lot of good reporting so far about how Europe is trying to position itself, how Asia is trying to position itself. But I think the only thing we can say now is people are watching very closely, and it feels like it's happening in their backyard.
I'll just add to a note about the divisions. One thing that really struck my ear last week when the president was speaking about how divided the country is right now is that he, while promising to try to do something about those divisions, as he did on election night, and he repeated that again, that he does see himself as the president of all people and wants to do something about it. He hasn't sort of specified what that something about it is. But he also clearly, if you listen to his words, sees the division, the political division in America, as an asset. Yeah. He said it is partially why he won the election, was how divided we are. Well, if that was part of his success, how deeply divided the country is, that to me sounds like an incentive for him if he sees it as a critical part of his political success. And I thought that was fascinating last week when he said that.
I think this is a good moment, though, for all of us to think about what our responsibility is, if any, to contributing to division. And the question I have is, do we use too many pundits? Because of the 24-hour news cycle, do we rely too much on people who make their living talking and selling books and therefore have a financial incentive to say things that will go viral? Cam, you're growling at me, so you are...
We don't! No!
Yeah. No, I mean, we're in a different... We don't have that constant... We're getting close, but we don't quite have the 24-hour-a-day cycle, so we don't have that...
Is that why you were glaring at me?
Yes.
Okay,
no, I wasn't
David L.
Smiling.
Look, punditry is a part of the business, just like reporters are. And we all have to fight and market ourselves, if you will, to get our stuff on air. Too much, too little, I guess we let the market decide on that a little bit. But
you don't think that's our responsibility to think about editorially? Or it should just be market-driven?
Do I think that it's...
Yeah, you.
Personally?
Yes.
Or does my network... Those are two very different things, potentially, right? I'm not saying that I disagree or agree with but I have my job to do, which is reporting. They look at it at a much higher level than perhaps I do, right, at a 50,000-foot view. And I think it is important that not just my voice gets out in the ether on whatever I'm reporting, but that a broad range of voices are heard by our viewers. And sometimes those are pundits' voices, and sometimes those are other reporters' voices.
We only have a few minutes left. Question.
Hi, I'm Ricky Klaus, and I'm a reporter at Channel 2 Action News here in Atlanta. And my question is, what is your advice on being the best reporter or journalist you can be in this current climate, and also keeping yourself personally sane and healthy?
Staying sane.
Well, that assumes that I am. So, but I would say, you go to the facts. You write a story. When I write a story, the editors make sure that every fact in it is correct, and it is grilled, and it is an intense process, and it goes out there into the world. And that's what I was doing before President Trump, and that's what I'll be doing while he's president. So, for however long that is.
Have you checked the odds lately?
Yeah.
Have you done the gambling on...
Yeah, I'm not going to bet on it.
Yeah, okay. One more question.
Okay. My name is Mariela Romero. I am with Univision, and I am from Venezuela, so I have a lot of things that are reminiscent of things that started to happen in my country 16 years ago. My question is about... I have so many things, but one question is, do we listen to each other? Because I have experienced this here. When I have something that I see in my community, in the Hispanic community here in Atlanta, and I want the mainstream media, the general market media, how we call it, to pay attention to, because it is a violation of civil rights, people say, oh, Col Mundo Hispanico, which is a newspaper in Spanish. And I said, this needs to be heard by everybody. So my point is, it's not only about diverse media or ethnic media, what it's called, but also when I first came to this country and I started listening talk radio. And I heard Rush Limbaugh calling us, Univision, as the Mexican station, which is not true because there is a foreign entity cannot broadcast in the United States, but his view, his listening audience thinks that we are a foreign entity.
I'm gonna cut you off here really quick because we only have a couple minutes left, but this, one of the things she is talking about is diversity, and we can't escape the fact that our four panelists are four white guys. So
I'm
are
Canadian,
we... Look, that's just how it is, look. Do we have a problem taking seriously issues that are going on in communities that we don't traditionally listen to? Do we put more emphasis on stories that historically have been important to what was mostly a white and mostly a male industry?
I think it is important that we get out into the communities. You know, we talked about local reporting and some of the impact that budget cuts and other things are having in those communities. And I think it is incumbent upon all of us to get out into the different communities and report on those stories. Immigration is one story, but income inequality and you name it are other stories. And I think getting out there and talking to people in those communities only makes us better reporters.
Mm-hmm. And taking, you're nodding your head, so I assume you agree.
Yeah, I just think a diversified newsroom across all kind, race, gender, geographic diversity, education diversity, socioeconomic diversity. I think a more diverse newsroom undoubtedly provides more complete and diverse storytelling.
Perspective.
Okay, we are about out of time. I want to say thank you to all of you. I want to say a special thank you to our panelists. David Chalian, CNN political director. Richard Fawcett is the New York Times, a New York Times national correspondent. There's only one. David Lukowitz is a producer for Fox News, and Cam McWhirter, political reporter for the Wall Street Journal.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, but you know we need to hear from you on this. What do you think of media coverage of the Trump administration so far? Are there certain news outlets that you trust more than others? Call 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us. Our handle is at OSTTalk, or you can post on our Facebook page. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.